So this week, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights will hear for the first time ever a case against a U.S. law enforcement agency. And the case involves the Border Patrol's alleged torture and killing of a man in its custody. Critics say the Border Patrol has operated with impunity for years, yet its size and power continue to grow. Today, we'll bring in snippets of our new Fault Lines documentary, Impunity on the Border, which investigated what critics are calling cover-up teams within the Border Patrol. Have a listen.
Todo eso es falso, realmente. Todo eso es falso.
Our critical incident team's coming out. They do all the kind of crime scene stuff, or not crime scene, but critical incident team.
What they teach you is you chase them until they crash.
Joining us to discuss today's topic is Andrea Guerrero. She's the executive director of Alliance San Diego. We also have Reese Jones from Honolulu. He's a political geographer and author of a great new book called Nobody is Protected, How the Border Patrol Became the Most Dangerous Police Force in the United States. And finally, Shaw Drake from El Paso, Texas. He's a senior policy counsel at the ACLU. Also, I want you to know we did reach out to CPB and Border Patrol several times to invite them on the show and for a comment, or at least provide some kind of video comment. But unfortunately, we got no response. So, all right, Andrea, help set this up for me. This week, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. What is that? Why is it so important at this time?
The Inter-American Commission is an international human rights body that has jurisdiction over the Americas, including the United States, and it specializes in hearing allegations of human rights. We are bringing the first ever case to the commission in a hearing this week, the case of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas versus the United States. And in that case, we are exposing the abuse and impunity that led to Anastasio's death and has been a systematic problem that has taken the lives of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in this country. This case is our effort to seek justice, not only for Anastasio, but to also seek policy reforms to keep this from happening.
Andrea, I want to bring in Anastasio's widow, Maria Piego. We have a bite from her, and this is from the Fault Line show, Impunity on the Border. We're going to put out a link to the show after this episode if you guys want to go watch it. But here, check out what Maria had to say.
What made them do that to a human being? He was a human being. He was a person who just wanted to come back to his family. What happened to my husband isn't fair. It isn't fair. They destroyed a family. They left my children without their family, and they killed him in the worst way.
Andrea, can you briefly tell us what actually happened to Anastasio, and why has it taken 12 years to search for accountability for the family?
Well, Anastasio was a longtime resident of San Diego. He had five children born here and a partner, Maria, who you just saw. And he wasn't able to get papers like millions of people in the United States. He didn't have a pathway to get legal status. And so when he encountered Border Patrol, they sought to deport him. They injured him in the process. He asserted his right to medical attention, and they denied it. Instead, they proceeded to beat him, torture him, shoot him with an electric taser various times, ultimately putting him into a positional asphyxiation until he stopped breathing. Mm. That was the abuse. That was chapter one of what had happened. Chapter two began immediately after, when border agents went up onto the bridge, the pedestrian bridge, where there were passersby, and took their cell phone videos, erased the footage that they had taken of the incident, dispersed the witnesses, and over the next several weeks proceeded to do everything they could to cover up what had happened. We, through this case, were able to piece together what exists in Border Patrol, which are cover-up teams, dedicated cover-up teams that have existed for more than 3 decades, called critical incident teams. And it is through this case that we were able to expose their longstanding work to obstruct justice at the largest law enforcement agency in the country.
Andrea, I want to get to the critical incident teams, which is the real focus of that Fault Lines documentary. I also want to get to this sense of impunity that you're talking about. At 12 years, there's been no accountability for what happened yet, Don Anastasio. To get there, though, I think first for our audience, we need to understand a little bit more about Border Patrol. Shah, how does Border Patrol stand out different than perhaps other law enforcement agencies?
Well, Josh, Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the United States, like you mentioned. It has nearly 20,000 agents that operate mainly within a 100-mile zone of any international boundary throughout the United States. CBP as an agency has close to 60,000 personnel. This is an agency that has tripled in size between the year 2000 and today, both in budget and in personnel. And with that massive growth has not come along the type of accountability measures or internal oversight mechanisms that you would expect at any law enforcement agency, particularly one with such massive reach. And so throughout those decades, we've seen Border Patrol act in extremely abusive ways and face zero accountability for those actions. We saw Border Patrol used to squash protests around the United States during the summer of 2020, when protests, Black Lives Matter and George Floyd protests across the country, were faced by the deployment of Border Patrol agents, by sniper units at George Floyd's burial service, and the agents that kidnapped people off the streets of Portland, those were Border Patrol agents. And so the agency is massive, has massive reach, deploys technology and various types of surveillance across the border region, with no accountability. And that's what we've unfortunately seen throughout the last few decades, and certainly since the incident with Anastasio in 2010.
You know, something you just said, I think, blows people's minds. When they think about Border Patrol, they think about mostly the southwestern U.S., the border between the U.S. and Mexico. But you just said 100 miles anywhere of the border, which includes the coastline. And the incredible fact is that includes what, like 2 out of 3 Americans, and yet this law enforcement agency that has this incredible reach seems to be playing by a different set of rules. Reese, can you touch on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people, Josh, are surprised to hear that the Border Patrol has authority in such a large area. 2/3 of the U.S. population, many of the largest cities in the United States, several entire states, including Hawaii, where I live. The entire state is in the border zone. And in that area, the Border Patrol has been given these special authorities that are different than regular police officers. A series of Supreme Court cases in the 1970s that I detail in my book, Nobody is Protected, gave them lower standards of evidence compared to other police. So they essentially have exceptions to the Fourth Amendment. All other police have to have a warrant or have to have probable cause to stop and interrogate a vehicle on a road inside the United States. But in that 100-mile zone, the Border Patrol has a lower standard of articulable facts of reasonable suspicion. And a case in 1975 at the Supreme Court laid out what those sorts of facts can be, and they're really broad. And they include race. So the Border Patrol is allowed to do racial profiling in all of their work. They can use race as one of the factors to stop a vehicle on a road inside the United States. And at checkpoints that they set up within that 100-mile zone, they can use race alone as the only factor in deciding to send a vehicle to extra inspection. So what we see with the Border Patrol is a force that has these exceptions to the regular laws of the United States. And the result is an out-of-control agency that has very little accountability to their work. They often work in very remote areas. And it results in violations of the rights of American citizens and immigrants alike.
Wait, Reese, I need you to expand on that just a bit, in the sense that normally in the media, when we say law enforcement is using race, and normally when we say that they are maybe stopping people without the right to, we're exposing that. But what you're actually saying here is that, oh, no, this is known and it is constitutionally allowed?
Yeah, there are two different ways that this has been authorized for the Border Patrol. The first is in the Supreme Court cases in the 1970s. There's Brignone Ponce in 1975 and then Martinez Fuerte in 1976. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court's decisions says that the Border Patrol can use race as one of the factors when they are making decisions about giving extra scrutiny to a vehicle at a checkpoint or in a roving patrol. This was reviewed in 2014 by the Obama administration. Eric Holder, the attorney general at the time, reviewed racial profiling for all federal agents and officers, and they banned racial profiling for most of those officers. But there's an exception in a footnote for immigration officials in the Border Patrol. So even the Obama administration continued to allow racial profiling for the Border Patrol.
And so that's what
Matt is actually... That is actually a part of our claim before the Inter-American Commission that will be heard this week, is that the systemic abuse and impunity is motivated by racial animus. And I think it's important for us to understand fundamentally what is wrong with law enforcement at the border. And that is that the standard for use of force is so low. It is a reasonableness standard that Reese pointed to. Well, that reasonableness standard is not the international human rights standard. The international human rights standard is necessary and proportional. And what we have gone to the Inter-American Commission to say is that the United States has violated its human rights violations, first and foremost, because they have a standard so low that the Border Patrol officers only need to claim that it was reasonable to kill, torture Anastasio, and that will exonerate them. That's exactly what happened, and that is why we have gone to this international body. That standard must change, not just for the Border Patrol, but for all law enforcement in this country. Places like Mexico directly incorporate the international human rights standard into their laws. The United States does not, even though they have signed onto treaties obligating them to follow this standard.
Shaw, what were you going to jump in and say there?
I'd also add that I think one of the most stark, examples of the way these principles problematically are playing out today, and it's detailed in the documentary, is within vehicle pursuits, the way that Border Patrol conducts vehicle pursuits particularly within the border region. We've documented and found that the number of deaths resulting from those vehicle pursuits has gone up 11-fold in just 2 years, and this year will be the deadliest on record. For people dying as a result of these deadly pursuits. The Border Patrol operates, again, under near zero transparency and accountability for their actions. And the case that's detailed in the Fault Lines documentary is a really stark example of the way the consequences for a lax policy and a lack of oversight and accountability, the consequences are people dying, and not just migrants who are fleeing apprehension. It's also occurred to innocent bystanders, to U.S. residents, to U.S. citizens, and it's a public safety issue and one that results really from this lack of regulation and oversight of the agency and its ability to conduct these type of racial profiling activities throughout the region.
So, Shaw, I want to stick with you just for a second, because you brought up the crash down in New Mexico, and this is in the Fault Lines documentary, Impunity on the Border. You were actually able to obtain a report from the Border Patrol's critical incident team. And that's special, because I think that's the only report ever made public by one of these teams. Can you touch on what you learned from that report?
Yeah, absolutely. We represent the mother of a U.S. citizen who was killed in that crash. And as part of our investigation on her behalf, we uncovered a Border Patrol critical incident team from the El Paso sector team. It was the main team responding to collect factual evidence from the scene of this accident. The report is problematic, to say the least. It has multiple areas of inconsistencies, multiple gaps in information. One of the most critical ones is radio traffic. Suggests that a sedan-style vehicle took over the chase, yet the photographs of the supposed vehicles involved in the chase are not a sedan. They're two SUVs. They look like they've already been washed and cleaned, and one of them is in a repair shop. There's no information about the chain of custody of that evidence. or how those pictures came to be within the report. And so just one example of the way that the report is wholly inadequate. And it was conducted by Border Patrol agents who were under the same chain of command as the agents who were involved in the crash. And that was the main factual document upon which the Office of Professional Responsibility, the internal oversight, the internal affairs agency who should have been investigating from the beginning, is basing their investigation and basing their ultimate findings. And so it really demonstrates the reason why these critical incident teams are highly problematic, both for the conflict of interest that exists just simply by their operation, as well as just the really shoddy and terrible investigation practices that are demonstrated within that report.
For a lot more on that report, everyone can tune into Impunity on the Border. It's the Fault Lines episode. It's on YouTube. You can look it up. You can find it on any of my social media at Josh Rushing. I have it linked and pinned. Reese, one of the things we're talking about here is law enforcement. I've said it. Almost every one of you guys have said it. But when I talk to Border Patrol people, it seems like they think of themselves more as military or paramilitary, and they see themselves as defending America from what they call an invasion. Just the semantics of that. Are they law enforcement or are they military? Are they defending the border or are they protecting the laws? What's going on with that?
Yeah, Josh, I think a lot of that changed after September 11th. Mm-hmm. The Border Patrol repositioned themselves in the aftermath of that event as what they think of as a front line against terrorist infiltration into the United States. And they used that positioning to get a lot more funding, a lot more agents. As Shaw mentioned, the number of agents has tripled since 2000. And so they think of themselves as part of the military. They think of themselves as the front lines against terrorism, as kind of this military defense force at the border. But the reality is the majority of the people that they're interacting with historically were migrant workers who were coming to the United States to work briefly inside the country to contribute to the economy of the United States. More recently, we see an even more need for humanitarian aid at the border. We see people fleeing violence abroad who are coming to the United States to apply for asylum, which is something that is completely legal to do. So over the last few years, we've seen these mostly families at the border who are bringing children and are looking for shelter and protection. So what we really need at the border is more social workers, more people with the ability to process asylum claims, people to provide aid to these desperate people in need. But instead, we've decided to meet that with a high-tech military force, with the latest gear from the battlefields abroad, redeployed inside the United States.
And I think the biggest problem that we have here with the border agencies is that regardless of how many they are, whether there were 100 agents or 20,000 agents, these agents don't abide by international human rights principles. And they and the border region are treated as an exception to the human rights norms and obligations, right? And so until and unless we as a country recognize that we have obligations to protect and respect human rights for everyone, everywhere, at all times. There's no exception for the migrant. There's no exception for the Black or Brown American. There's no exception in the border region, period. But what we have is a network of laws and policies that make exceptions. They make exceptions to allow for racial profiling. They make exceptions to allow for warrantless searches. They make exceptions in every single way to treat migrants and the people living in the border region and traveling through it as lesser than. And that is the fundamental problem. And so the Inter-American Commission is the first opportunity that we have to confront the U.S. government as a whole. This case is, that we're carrying is not against individual agents. It's against the U.S. government for a system that violates human rights every day of the year.
And I just want to point out here, I want to share something off my computer. This is off of Instagram from the Southern Border Coalition. And it said more than 220 people have been killed in encounters with CBP since 2010. So you have a high number of these kind of fatal encounters. And yet, the fact I learned in reporting this episode is that no Border Patrol agent has ever been convicted of a homicide while in uniform. And it's this sense of, is that impunity? Why and how? Where does that impunity come from? We have a video comment from someone in our community that I want to share. This is Adam Isaacson. He's the director of defense oversight at WOLA, the Washington Office of Latin America. Here, listen to this.
Our criminal justice system almost never brings convictions against Border Patrol agents for cases of even homicide or manslaughter. Even when prosecutors try, juries tend to find that it was a case of self-defense or that, you know, the agent didn't violate policy. Internally, there is an Office of Professional Responsibility. There is an Internal Complaints Office. There is an Inspector General's Office. But these all tend to be slow, unresponsive, and often quite timid. The end result is, impunity is near total for Border Patrol agents in cases of human rights abuse. There is a desperate need for reform right now.
Shaw, is that true? Is impunity near total for Border Patrol agents?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's absolutely accurate. And the reason why is, as Adam mentioned briefly, is that there is this unworkable, overlapping, mosaic puzzle of internal accountability mechanisms within the Department of Homeland Security that simply aren't getting the results that they should. So you have the Office of Inspector General, you have the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and you have the Office of Professional Responsibility. Just to give two quick examples, the Office of Professional Responsibility can conduct factual investigations into these deaths or other incidents. Let's assume for a second that the critical incident teams aren't mucking up the evidence collection and you know, affecting the outcome. Even if they report that an agent violated policy or law, those decisions on whether that agent is disciplined goes to sector leadership. It goes to the supervisors and bosses of the person who did the misconduct.
Right,
and of course,
right.
No boss wants to be admitting that the employees below them are conducting themselves inappropriately. Also,
hey,
the civil rights and civil... Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, Shaw, I got about a minute and a half left in the whole show here. I want to bring in a couple of comments from YouTube. And, Reese, I'm coming to you. This says, a question for the panel. What do you suggest as an alternative for how the Border Patrol is handling it right now? I also want to say someone else said we need a Border Lives Matter movement. Reese, do we need a Border Patrol?
I don't think we need a Border Patrol. The United States didn't have a Border Patrol until 1924. So the Border Patrol has existed for less than 100 years. And it was created in 1924 to enforce a racist law, the national origin quotas that were based in eugenics. So it's an agency founded in white supremacy. It's an agency that's allowed to do racial profiling and that has violent and racially unequal results in their actions. So I would say, no, we don't need a Border Patrol. But if we were to think even at a scale of, okay, we keep a Border Patrol, but we could scale it down. We don't need so many Border Patrol agents. And moreover, they don't need to be patrolling up to 100 miles inside the United States, right?
Hey, Reese,
160 kilometers.
I've got to end it there. But people can go to your book to get more on that. They can go to Fault Lines, Impunity on the Border to find out a lot more about this. Again, we invited the Border Patrol to be a part of the show. They declined to. I want to thank all of my guests, Andrea, Reese, Shaw, and you for joining us. See you next time on the stream.